claims or damages received from any product advertised within this program. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
It is sad to think that sooner or later those you love will do the same for you. And you may have thought it tragic, not to mention other adjectives, to think of all the weeping they will do. But don't you worry, no more ashes, no more sackcloth, and an armband made of black cloth will someday nevermore adorn a sleeve. For if the bomb that drops on you gets your friends and neighbors too, there'll be nobody left behind to grieve, and we will all go together when we go. What a comforting fact that is to know. Universal bereavement, an inspiring achievement. Yes, we all will go together when we go. We will all go together when we go. All suffused with an incandescent glow. No one will have the endurance to collect on his insurance. Lloyd's of London will be loaded when they go. We will all fry together when we fry. We'll be French fried potatoes by and by. There will be no more misery when the world is our rotisserie. Yes, we all will fry together when we fry. We will all bake together when we bake. There'll be nobody present at the wake. With complete participation in that grand incineration, nearly 3 billion hunks of well-done steak. We will all char together when we char. And let there be no moaning of the bar. Just sing out a te deum when you see that ICBM, and the party will be come as you are.
Well, this is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Raw Deal. I want to begin with a report from one of my best correspondents, Beverly, who happens to be a black woman intellectual. Her comments are spot on. She wrote to me as follows about the Need to Know presentation for November 3rd, which those who are unaware may not know are all available on my BitChute channel, Jim Fetzer. You can access. Just put in BitChute channel, Jim Fetzer, and you're there. Beverly writes, if you want to unite the races, try to take away their guns. Black people are not going to readily give up their guns any more than whites are. I don't care if most blacks vote Democrat. They aren't about to hand over the handguns they keep for protection, especially those in high crime neighborhoods. Blacks in rural areas, just like their white brethren, have always had rifles and handguns. The nearest police station is probably miles away. And by the time the cops arrive, it's too late to stop any criminal behavior. Black people, even those who promote the false narrative otherwise, know the black criminal is more of a threat to them than the cops. If gun confiscation ever becomes reality, the black market in weapons will be a booming business with a beeline of upstanding black citizens buying guns to protect themselves, along with the black and white criminals who already make up the underground weapon market customer base. Also, on my blog, some comments too good not to share. I've just posted, for example, about a new book by Mike Palachek, who in the past has been my series editor. Thus, Mike and I founded moonrockbooks.com after Amazon banned Nobody Died at Sandy Hook. It was a FEMA drill to promote gun control. Less than a month after it went on sale, even though it had sold nearly 500 copies, because of 13 contributors, including six PhD professors, current or retired, established The school had been closed by 2008. It was loaded with asbestos and other biohazards. There were no students or teachers there. It was a two-day FEMA drill, technically a mass casualty exercise involving children, presented as mass murder to promote gun control, where one of the contributors, Paul Preston, himself a school administrator, has supervised active shooting drills in the past and was so disturbed by what he saw being broadcast from Newtown that day that he reached out to his contacts in the Obama Department of Education, all of whom confirmed to him it had been a drill, no kids had been harmed, and it was done to promote gun control. So the Obama Department of Education knew it was a stunt. Obviously, Obama knew it was a stunt. Joe Biden knew it was a stunt. Eric Holder was the main conduit who met with the governor of Connecticut on the 27th of November, just a few weeks before this would all transpire on the 13th and the 14th of December, to tell him they were going to take an abandoned school and use it to conduct a drill to promote gun control. And he signed on with it. He later explained that he and the governor had been spoken to that something like this might happen, leading me to analyze what could he have meant, something like this. There were only two possibilities, after all, that he'd been warned that a nut might go crazy and shoot up a bunch of kids in a public school, in which case he obviously had the obligation to notify the school system so they could take measures to ensure it did not happen, which he did not do, or alternatively, as I've sketched, he was being informed they were going to take an abandoned school and conduct a drill and present it as a real mass murder to promote gun control, which is, of course, exactly what they did. In fact, the mayor of Boston at the time had appeared on a show called Greater Boston, hosted by Andy Rooney's daughter just a couple of weeks earlier, where he was boasting of his friendship with the vice president. And the vice president had told him that by January of 2013, about 2 months away or less, that gun control would be a done deal. And Andy Rooney's daughter was in shock. She said, "What in the world could happen to make legislation pass so fast?" Well, the mayor wouldn't admit, but of course it was Sandy Hook. And sure enough, on the 16th of January, 2013, just a month and 2 days after the event, the staged event, Barack Obama signed no less than 23 executive orders to constrain our access to weapons under the Second Amendment. I mean, this man is so despicable, I cannot begin to tell you, because this was an act of terrorism, instilling fear into the hearts and minds of every parent across America. It was an act of terrorism by Barack Obama, Joe Biden, Eric Holder, Governor Malloy, the Newtown School Board, the participants in Sandy Hook, an immense fraud, and Amazon banned the book. Of course, they'd have to ban the book. I mean, after all, they only have 19 other books on sale, every one of which confirmed one way or another the official narrative of 20 kids and 6 adults having been killed. How could they stand to have one that disputed the account? Well, the answer is because it was the only objective scientific account that went through all the evidence and presented it, including the manual for the event, which I included as Appendix A to the book. When it was banned, it was obvious to me this was a political stunt, so I immediately released it for free as a PDF. A colleague who follows these matters has told me it appears to have been downloaded as much as 10 million times. Well, that was perfect for me because I was never in this for money, only to get the word out. So Mike and I, after it was banned, founded moonrockbooks.com. And now, would you believe, of the 12 volumes that have been published at Moonrock Books, Amazon has banned 5 more. Total of 6, half of the 12. Not only on Sandy Hook, but on the Boston bombing, on Orlando and Dallas, on the moon landing, on Charlottesville, on Parkland. Now, the moon landing ban came later. It had already been up for a year and a half or so when it was banned, apparently, at the request of the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, which can be best envisioned as the intellectual arm of the Mossad, asked that any books that disputed the official narrative of World War II, in particular the account of 6 million Jews having been put to death in gas chambers using Zyklon B, should be banned. And because, and I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, includes a section of the perhaps the best articles ever published on the matter. The book's now in a second edition. I went out of my way to give you the very best by the revisionist historians who've sorted all this out to tell you what really happened. Well, they can't stand that because, after all, a Jewish and Israeli political clout is rooted in a Western sense of guilt over the Holocaust. So that if you dispute, if you explain by objective evidence that the Holocaust had no scientific or historical foundation, where the International Committee of the Red Cross, who is keeping meticulous records on the sex, the age, the race, the ethnicity, the religion of everyone who died in all of the camps and their causes of death, and in 1993 recalibrated their numbers with a total 296,081 from all causes combined, none of whom died from being put to death in a gas chamber. You begin to get the idea. Now, I've been pilloried for this again and again. I want to encourage you to search for the Holocaust narrative, politics, Trump's science, to review the evidence for yourself. Because frankly, once you begin to dig into this, it's not that tough. It just, the narrative falls apart. That's why they have to censor it so massively. Well, Mike's a terrific guy. He's got a new book now, which I'm featuring, announcing on my blog at jamesfetzer.org. So here's a commentary that came from one of my best commentators on the blog. This isn't a reply to Mike Palachek's work here, though his quote from William L. Shires, The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, is puzzling. The cynical disregard for truth that propaganda Shire projects onto Hitler and Goebbels is his own practice anyway. This is more of a response to the Jim's Bit Shoot broadcasts, which are dealing with self-defense issue. Headline. Guilty verdicts reached in Almond Aubrey case after crucial evidence is withheld from the jury. Listen to this. I think it's imprudent to suggest that the Georgia men were classic hillbillies and that somehow their self-defense was racist or less authentic than that of Rittenhouse. Rittenhouse may be a fine young man, but those men had the same grounds for self-defense as Kyle did. A would-be robber ran at the rifle and grabbed the barrel of the gun. It doesn't matter if you're impressed with a white man's social situation or not. It's a clear case of justified self-defense. How I scoff at the howls of jogging while black. Aubrey was a criminal already known to local businesses and cops as the jogger because he would do running stretches outside a store and then go inside, grab stuff, and run away. Aubrey did the same stretches and pretend jogging in neighborhoods with new construction, just like the one in which the convicted men owned property. They were on watch for criminals thieving from the neighborhood half-built houses. There had been a rash of thefts in the neighborhood, and many homeowners installed security cameras. No less than 5 times, Aubrey had been captured on cameras inside one house being built just 2 doors down from the convicted father and son. 12 nights before the shooting, he had been inside the same house when he was spotted and sprinted off. Armed neighbors, including the father and son, gathered and called the cops. The cops came, searched for Aubrey, In finding nothing, thank the neighbors for helping with security. On the day of the shooting, Aubrey was again inside the unfinished house when he was spotted and ran out past the father, who was working in his yard. He called his son, got in the truck, and followed the Aubrey. Jared Taylor has written an article that recounts the events leading up to the shooting in detail. Taylor writes, one of the first prosecutors on the case, George Barnhill, wrote a report, well worth reading in full, that the defense surprisingly never referred to, that has been all but forgotten. It concludes that the three men were trying to make a legal citizen's arrest, were legally armed, and had probable cause to believe that Aubrey had committed a burglary. Mr. Barnhill wrote, given the fact Aubrey initiated the fight, at that point, Aubrey grabbed the gun. Under Georgia law, McMichael was allowed to use deadly force to protect himself. His conclusion, we do not see grounds for an arrest of any of the three parties. He probably thought it was unnecessary to add the obvious that if the men had wanted to kill Aubrey rather than stop and talk to a man they thought might be armed, they could have done so as they drove close to him, or that people who are about to commit a murder do not call 911 or make a video that they immediately turn over to the police. Mr. Barnhill based his report not just on interviews, but also on the Brian video, which was not made public until later. This is very significant as a nice illustration of how badly we are played by the media and even by the local law enforcement, where the influence of George Soros appears to have been enormous. Now, I'm extremely pleased to say that my guest today, Sophia Smallstorm, will be joining us after the break. Meanwhile, let me review a few of the more recent developments here of which you need to be aware. Maximum red alert. Unelected EU president calls for forced inoculations. UK, Australia, US also developing plans for forced injections. Mind you, this is grossly in violation of the Nuremberg Code, which declares the principles upon which these governments ought to be acting, including, of course, voluntary consent, which requires that you be informed of all the risks as well as all the purported benefits of the experimental procedure to which you're being subjected, not to mention the alternatives available that are less invasive, which naturally include HCQ, hydroxychloroquine, and ivermectin. Indeed, these HCQ and ivermectin have been so successful that but for the demonization and suppression of those alternative treatments, these drugs would not have even been eligible for experimental use authorization. If the situation is as grotesque as any ever confronted by humanity, and in my judgment represents the greatest threat to the survival of the vast majority of humans on planet Earth ever to be encountered, greatly exceeding that of all world wars in the past put together, where, in my judgment, Anthony, Tony the Rat Fauci, will go down as the greatest mass murderer in all of history, far exceeding the totals of death and devastation wreaked by all of our foreign enemies combined, Joseph Stalin, Adolf Hitler, Emperor Hirohito, throw in Chairman Mao Zedong, throw in Pot Paul. They're going for the world record here, and Anthony Fauci, who has an unbelievable record in relation to these issues, which I'm glad to say is being exposed by Bobby Kennedy Jr., has been at the forefront. He's been at the center of it all. Let me say a few words, by the way, about Bobby Jr.'s book. He exposes that Fauci has a history regarding AIDS and Ebola and other issues that lead to the justifiable conclusion he ought to be criminally prosecuted, investigated alongside of Bill Gates. Bobby Kennedy Jr. told Michael Cohen, Trump's former disgraced lawyer, that Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci should be criminally prosecuted. On an episode of Cohen's podcast, Mea Culpa with Michael Cohen, he asked Bobby Jr., based on your findings, do you believe that Dr. Fauci and Bill Gates should be investigated for criminal wrongdoing? Kennedy, chairman of Children's Health Defense, who's been doing a brilliant job, responded with a simple yes. He went on to say he thinks that because of Fauci's policies, 80% of those who have died from COVID should not have died. We should have been doing early treatment like the Chinese did in April. They had protocols with the drugs we know are effective. Anticoagulants, anti-inflammatory steroids, hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine, and then vitamins, vitamin D. They obliterated the pandemic after a month and a half using early treatment. The Chinese had 3 deaths per million, but Tony Fauci had 2,200 American deaths per million. We have the biggest body count in the world because of his policies. He said that, of course, Fauci should be criminally charged. He deliberately sabotaged by using fraudulent methodologies to suppress ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, and promoted a drug he knew was, in fact, deadly. Remdesivir. Deadly. The podcast description labeled Kennedy a COVID conspiracy king, except we're dealing here with conspiracy facts, conspiracy reality. I recall on my way to a JFK conference having been contacted by a major television outlet in Minneapolis asking how I'd like to be described. And I said, as a conspiracy realist or as a conspiracy analyst. We know now, of course, that as I've been seeking to explain, conspiracy theorists are investigating crimes that the government has not solved, no doubt deliberately, because they lead back to the government's own complicity in the crimes. Thus, the CIA introduced the term a conspiracy theorist in response to critics of the Warren Commission who are poking holes in the official narrative, many of which, in my opinion, where the American people were profoundly disturbed, because if you go back to the coverage that was occurring on the very day of the event, 22 November 1963, if you watch, for example, NBC, See It Now, they're reporting 2 wounds the president had sustained, a small, clean puncture wound to the throat, which Malcolm Perry, MD, a surgeon at Parkland Hospital, had seen up close and personal, performing a straight line incision through the wound for it to introduce a tracheostomy, and where 3 times during the Parkland press conference at 1:30 Central Time that day to the assembled press, he explained the bullet was coming at him, that it was a wound of entry. Many of you may also recall when Malcolm Kilduff, the acting press secretary, announced the death of the 35th president of the United States. He pointed to his right temple and said it was a simple matter of a bullet right through the head, attributed to Admiral George Berkeley, the president's personal physician. Those 2 wounds, both of which were caused by shots fired from in front, were widely broadcast on radio and television that day. So I have no doubt that when the Warren Commission issued its report claiming that there had been only 3 shots, all of which had been fired from above and behind, subliminally, whether they remembered those accounts where they were glued to the television set all day or not, they had to have good reason to doubt what they were being told. And indeed, of course, they were being played. The public has been played. Lyndon Johnson was a key player here. The whole event originated in Los Angeles in 1960 when JFK beat him for the Democratic nomination. Jack invited Stuart Symington, senator from Missouri, to be his running mate, but gave him overnight to think about it. Bobby, meanwhile, went past the Johnson suite to extend a pro forma invitation to the Senate majority leader, never imagining in his wildest dreams Lyndon would have the least interest. Instead, he was flabbergasted when Lyndon jumped on it, threatened to expose that Jack had Addison's disease, which meant he wasn't going to live a long, healthy life, that among his dalliances was one with a beautiful woman who was a spy for East Germany, information he'd been provided by J. Edgar, who despised Jack just as much as he did himself, and that if he were not on the ticket, then any legislative proposal sent down from the White House would be dead on arrival because in his position as a powerful majority leader, he would bottle them up. Bobby and Jack tried to figure a way around, but Lyndon had them boxed in. So they had to accede to his demands. When one of Johnson's wealthy backers learned he would be on the ticket and helped JFK become president, he burst into the Johnson suite cursing and swearing because he was distraught. Bobby Baker took him into a bedroom and explained what they had in mind. He came out all smiles, saying he thought that was an excellent plan. Meanwhile, or thereafter, Bobby Baker would declare publicly that JFK would not live out his first term and that he would die a violent death. In the course of events, shortly before, Lyndon sent his chief administrative assistant, Cliff Carter, down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements were in place for the assassination. Sad to say, Oliver Stone's new film, JFK Revisited, does not reveal these facts about the assassination. We know what happened. Let me invite every one of you to compare JFK Revisited with my real deal JFK special on 18 November, knowing his film would be released on the 22nd, and compare and contrast. Compare and contrast. I once again brought together groups of experts who were expert in fields I was not to sort out what really happened. We put it together. Oliver, alas, did not. When I return, my special guest, Sophia Smallstorm, will join us.
Radio at freedomslips.com, and we'll be right back after this message.
Management would like to take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Hey, everyone. It's Barbara Jean Lindsay, the Cosmic Oracle. If you have questions about your past lives or future plans, need answers from the cosmos about your love life or career, or just want to keep your finger on the pulse of the planet, check out my show, The Cosmic Oracle, here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? that the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities, and that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio-quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out And Nobody Died in Boston Either. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, my guest today has done simply brilliant work on a whole host of subjects. She had a video about 9/11 that was completely sensational. She did one of the best ever documentaries about Sandy Hook in 2, 3, 4, and 5 dimensions that has ever been produced. She covers a wide range of issues. Today, she's very keen on the vaccine transhumanistic aspects, but she's welcome to discuss or address any issue she believes important enough to raise today. Sophia, welcome back to The Raw Deal.
Whoops, I muted so that I could take in your address, your, you know, extolling all my capabilities. Yeah, Jim. So I'm not that great. I'm just a regular person. Remember that. Can you hear me?
Very clearly, Sophia. Yes. And in my opinion, you are simply exemplary among citizen investigators. You've done so much good work on so many important issues. You deserve those accolades.
Well, thank you, Jim. Well, you know, I sent you a newsletter that I released a couple of weeks ago. I'm a little bit behind. And I wanted to explain what I understood as I wrote this newsletter, more about the language of biology. I mean, we are very unaware of what goes on in our bodies, you know, the digestion, all the cellular replenishment, the repairs, imagine if we had to consciously keep track of this, right?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, we wouldn't be able to. It's too many. It's the orchestra is too big. It's just like the conductor can't play every instrument. And he stands there and he just moves his arm and the orchestra plays. But it's every individual instrument and everybody playing that instrument and the years of study that they've put into it. So I want to start with this because you and I talked about it a little bit on the phone. I don't know if you've ever seen this in person, but people who call themselves a human calculator, have you ever been in the presence of such a person?
No, but I've certainly heard of them, yes.
All right, so these are people who can do math at lightning speed, and you just throw them a very, you know, intricate calculation, like, you know, 50,486.2 divided by 966.77895. And boom, they tell you the answer. Now, how is that possible, right? You're a professor of logic. So forget that I talked to you last week. How would you be able to explain that?
Oh, Sophia, they have a gift that it's virtually, you know, unconscious that they can do this. I don't know that it's explicable other than that they have a unique combination of genes and experience that enables them to perform tasks that no ordinary mortal could perform.
Well, all right. So mortal, okay, that's a figure of speech here, because people, human beings, mortals, can indeed perform like this. You can do it by studying and training, and you get to a certain level of proficiency, of ability. But then there are the people who have a whole different language working in them, and this is what I'm going to discuss. So just bear with me. So there was a guy, his name was Banu Prakash. This isn't the person that I saw at Barnes & Noble, because I went there, I don't even know when it was, in the 90s. And some Indian guy, it's often Indians, tell me why, right? Indian guy was standing there and he said, I'm a human calculator, just tell me whatever sum you want and I'll do it. So he was using the number block method. And that is actually something we can all do if you concentrate enough. So you're keeping track of blocks of numbers, because multiplication is really just repetitive addition. If you say 543 times 8, you could go 500 times 8, 40 times 8, 3 times 8, and add them all up in your mind, and boom, that's the answer, right?
Yes.
So that's the number block method. And I figured this out years ago, and I was trying to teach myself, but my brain couldn't stand doing this. It could not stand keeping one answer in mind and then adding the next one and the next one. So there's this kid in India, Banu Prakash. He's 5 years old. Today he's in his early 20s. But what happened to him was he fell from his cousin's scooter, motorbike kind of thing, and he fell and hit his head on the road. And so he had surgery after surgery, and he was in a medically induced coma because the doctor said he had to heal all those brain injuries that he had. And he woke up bedridden for a year. He couldn't get out of bed. They wouldn't let him because he was so fragile. So all he could do was solve puzzles and play chess. Now, he was only 6, but he had the presence of mind to say to himself, I'm going to train myself to be as adept as I can solving puzzles and playing chess, because this is going to help me in my future. Otherwise, he would have been very dysfunctional. So he trained his brain. And he explained on to CNN that when he attempts like a world record in math calculation, he said it's kind of like I'm the Flash, the comic book Flash superhero. When Flash runs, everything else around him is blurred. And that's how I feel doing this math. Everything around me is blurred. I'm moving very, very fast. It's very liberating. But he doesn't consider himself a prodigy or a savant. This is the word we're getting into, savant. Because he used that training method, number block. You could do it, Jim. Anybody could do this if they sat in bed long enough and worked on chess and puzzles, right? So I found this book a while back, Born on a Blue Day, and this is by Daniel Tammet, who is from the United Kingdom. Now, this guy is a savant. He's what's called a mathematical savant. He's categorized as autistic. And he has a whole different way of doing math. And I read this book and I didn't even grasp how his brain worked until I reread the parts that had the descriptions. So first of all, most people who are autistic savants, they could never even explain to you in words what is going on inside them. This guy is lucky because through dedication and perseverance, he has socialized himself enough to use verbal communication in a way that you and I can actually talk to him. A lot of these other savants, autistic, or whatever, however they're classified, they just are very, very different, very unusual. They don't communicate. They're not emotional. And I'll get into all of that. So Daniel, as a little boy, he would toddle down the stairs and bring up to his bedroom his parents' books. And he carried them one at a time. And these were heavy hardcover books. And he would trip and fall on the stairs. But he loved piling the books up in his room. And he wouldn't let his parents take them out of his room. And he would sort the books into piles so that he made like these towers around himself on his bedroom floor. And if his parents came to remove the books, he would have a horrible tantrum and burst into tears. So what he loved about the books was the pages with the numbers on them. And he says he would sit there long before I could read the sentences on the pages. I could count the numbers. And when I counted, the numbers would appear as motions or colored shapes in my mind. So that's the part that's so hard for us to understand. Numbers for Daniel were actually landscapes. They were not only motile, moving, but they had personalities. And he writes that, for instance, the five is a clap of thunder. The number five. I mean, what is the number five to you? It's a certain shape on a piece of paper, or you look at your fingers on your hand and you go, okay, this is five. But to him, it was a clap of thunder. And the sound of waves crashing against rocks. 37, he said, the number 37, lumpy like porridge. 89 is falling snow. So he had this completely different, it's called synesthesia. It is a rare neurological mixing of senses. And people see alphabetical letters or they see numbers with entirely different and multiple kinds of properties to them, right? So please give me some feedback as a professor of logic.
Oh, go forward, Sophia. It's fascinating. Continue.
All right. So I'm just afraid that break is going to come and mess me up.
No, like I'll let you know. You got more than 10, you got nearly 15 minutes.
Oh, good. Okay. So all these numbers had these different personalities. And the way, for instance, I will read this to you. This is how he did multiplication. I see each result of power multiplication, which is like 43 times 43 times 43, squares, cubes, and whatnot, exponential patterns, as distinctive visual patterns. As the sums and their results grow, the mental shapes and colors I experience become increasingly more complex. I see 37's fifth power, so that's 37 times 37 times 37, five times, as a large circle composed of smaller circles running clockwise from the top around. And then what happens is when he sees these movements in his mind, he translates them and he gets an answer. So he sees all these shapes and colors and he calls them numberscapes, or I call them numberscapes, and he translates them. So when you tell him like 683, times 596, he sees 683 as this moving mass with colors and maybe snow or whatever, and the other number the same, and then they meld and merge, and then a new shape happens with different movements, and then he knows what number that is. In the case of 37 to the fifth power, the answer is 69,343,957. And he gets that in his mind out of like snow and movement. And so he can do any calculation, because he's not sitting there multiplying. He doesn't have an adding machine in him. He has this synesthetic sense of numbers, wholly different from what you and I have.
Yes.
So here he said,
wholly different indeed, Sophia. Yes.
Yeah. So he says, I never write anything down when I'm calculating because I've always been able to do the sums in my head. And it's much easier for me to visualize the answer using my synthetic shapes than to use the carry the one techniques taught in school. When multiplying, I see the two numbers as distinct shapes. The image changes and a third shape emerges, the correct answer. The process takes a matter of seconds and happens spontaneously. It's like doing math without having to think. When I look at a sequence of numbers, my head begins to fill with colors, shapes, textures that knit together spontaneously to form a visual landscape. These are always very beautiful to me. As a child, I often spent hours at a time exploring numerical landscapes in my mind. To recall each digit, I simply retrace the different shapes and textures in my head and read the numbers out of them. Okay. So Daniel's big challenge was to break the European record of memorizing pi. You know what pi is, right?
Sure. 3.14.
Yeah. So pi is what they call an irrational number because it doesn't have any patterns. It's not a repeating decimal. It's an infinite decimal. It goes on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And so some computer in Tokyo calculated pi into the millions of decimals. But as far as human beings went, I think the European record was 22,500 decimals. And he wanted to break that record. So his challenge was to recite the decimals of pi as far as he could go, learning them in the next 3 months. And somebody, just so you know how hard this is to do, mathematicians throughout the ages have spent time calculating pi. There was a guy, William Shanks from England. He took 15 years to get to the 707th place of pi, which he published in 1873. But he had made this colossal error in the 528th place. So all the numbers after that were wrong.
That's pretty embarrassing.
It's terrible, isn't it? Yeah, so here's Daniel saying, okay, I'm going to see how far I can get in the next 3 months, and I'm going to try to go past 22,500 places. So how did he do it? All right. So he did not memorize pi, Jim. He drew it in his mind in the form of a rolling hillscape that darkened and dipped and curved and meandered. So when he would recite pi in the contest, he would simply recall this landscape. And the closest I can come to this is like you and I recalling our memories, because our memories play out as a movie in our mind, at least mine do. And I've talked to a few people, and yeah, they see everything. They see all the details. You miss some, but you can recollect quite a number of details if you have a distinct memory that stays with you. So I'm going to just read you this because it's wild. So he's in this hall, and this is the big day. And he posed for some photos, and then his feet had to start, and they were timing it. So he writes in his book, "And so I recited the by now very familiar opening digits of pi, the numerical landscapes in my head growing and changing as I went along. As I recited, the checkers crossed off each number as it was correctly recalled. There was a state of almost complete silence throughout the hall, except for the very occasional muffled cough or footsteps as someone quietly moved. The noises didn't bother me because I could feel myself becoming absorbed within the visual flow of colors and shapes, textures and motion. I was surrounded by my numerical landscapes. The reciting became almost melodic as each breath was filled with number upon number upon number, and then I suddenly realized that I was totally calm. It took a little over 10 minutes to complete the first 1,000 digits. I reached 10,000 digits at 1:15 in the afternoon, just over 2 hours from the start of the recitation. As the hours passed, I could feel myself becoming more and more tired. The visual landscapes in my mind were becoming increasingly blurred as the fatigue started to set in. I hadn't ever recited all the digits together. I hoped I would be able to finish. By mid-afternoon, I was exhausted. It felt as though I had run a marathon in my head. At exactly 4:15, my voice shaking with relief, I recited the last digit, 6765748695358 7. and signaled that I had finished. I had recited 22,514 digits of pi without error in a time of 5 hours, 9 minutes to set a new British and European record.
Fascinating.
Okay, so now he was asked, why did you do this? You know, were you just trying to set a record? And his answer was, pi is for me an extremely beautiful and utterly unique thing. Like the Mona Lisa or a Mozart symphony, pi is its own reason for loving it. Now.
Yes. The aesthetics of mathematics.
Right. But that's what you and I say about people. Now, Daniel did not have any ability to relate to people. He writes in his book, if he encountered someone who said, oh, I'm having a bad day, he didn't know how to respond to that. Clueless. Now, you and I would say, oh, really? What's going on? You know, sit down, tell me about it. Here, let's go out for coffee. He can't do any of that. No emotional ability to relate to anybody, but this is what he can do with numbers. So you and I have a natural language, Jim, that we share with all other kinds of normal people who are not savants. We are able to relate to other people, languages, conversation. I mean, you and I constantly meet people. We can enjoy them. We can do things with them. We can have long phone call conversations. We can love them, share them, build lives with a few of them. An autistic person can't do that. The normal social surrounding makes them shriek and bang their head against the wall, right? So then I was thinking about this. I was thinking about, all right, well, if you or I lived in a world where everybody else could do these calculations at lightning speed with no effort, well, maybe we also would cry and shriek and bang our head against the wall, right? If we didn't have that ability.
Potentially, go ahead.
Yeah, so with these, I mean, look, you and I can drive down, walk down a city street. We can get through a crowd. We can go into a supermarket or a bank. We can drive a car in rush hour. Savants cannot do that. It just completely derails them. They can't do that. So we have the ability to integrate life in, I wouldn't say it's all linguistic, but to take in these images and everything, all the sensory stuff that comes in, we can manage it. He can only manage numbers. So when a mathematical savant says, pi is for me an extremely beautiful and utterly unique thing and is its own reason for loving it, this is what you or I would say about another person. This is what you say about your wife or your fiance or somebody, right? So they are completely different. They have a completely different neurological experience of life. Theirs is very segmented into one very deep, very remarkable category. And ours is much broader, but it maybe that to them is mastery of multiple categories of sensory input.
Yes, so, yes, because numbers are virtually living things, virtually alive.
Right. I mean, they're inputs, and they translate those numbers, they translate numerics into sensory input. I mean, how do I explain it? They make it emotional, they make it color, they make it everything that how we see life. I mean, when he's in the normal setting of a playground, what can he do? This is when he's a kid. He distances himself from the other kids because they're too rowdy. And there's too much, you know, he might get hit by a ball or pushed. And he goes off to the side and he counts pebbles, counts fence posts, counts something, because that calms him down. That is his normal world. It's just count, 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 count.
Continue. Yes. Tell us more.
How many minutes have I got?
Well, before the break, about 3. And then you'll have another half hour, of course.
All right. So, Jim, I'm going to go into biology because it dawned on me that we have a language running in us that is just like Daniel Tammet's numerical language. he doesn't know how he does these calculations. Stuff just appears in his head, and he knows how to translate this whirling image, and it's the right answer to this very difficult question or calculation. So in biology, there is some kind of program running in us, and it's keeping in concert, correct concert and balance, everything. And we are the owners of it, but we do not know how it works. So this is what's being changed in the labs by the white coats. They have figured out how to hack that biological language. And that's what I'm going to get into next.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, Sophia, there's rather fascinating stuff. I mean, are we talking specifically about autistic kids who seem to be gifted in certain ways, or is there a different way to differentiate the class that have this extraordinary mathematical ability?
Well, look, Jim, all I know is I read one book by a savant who managed to convey how it felt or what this process was like for him more than anyone else has been able to. And by the way, he can do it with languages, too. Languages are patterns. He's just very good at working patterns. And he learned Icelandic in 1 week and had an interview on Icelandic television in Icelandic.
Yes, yes.
So our biology runs in this way, beneath our consciousness, beyond our knowledge. And this technocratic world has figured out how to get in there and mess with it. And that's what I'm going to go into next. And I'm going to start with the organization of life. On Wikipedia, I'm just going to go there. Wiki tells us there's no consensus on the definition of life. Life is a characteristic that distinguishes physical entities with biological processes from those that are inanimate or have no biological processes. That's it. That's one is life and one is not life. Okay? So.
Which one? Yes, yes. Well, ingesting, digesting, excreting are all elements of life. There are restraints on mobility, whether we're talking about plant life versus animal life and the like. But I think this is all very worthy of further exploration. Stand by. Sophia Smallstorm will continue right after this break.
Radio at freedomslips.com. We'll be right back after this message.
Was it a conspiracy? Did you know that the police in Boston were broadcasting, "This is a drill, this is a drill," on bullhorns during the marathon? That the Boston Globe was tweeting that a demonstration bomb would be set off during the marathon for the benefit of bomb squad activities? And that one would be set off in 1 minute in front of the library, which happened as the Globe had announced. Peering through the smoke, you could see bodies with missing arms and legs, but there was no blood. The blood only showed up later and came out of a tube. They used amputee actors and a studio quality smoke machine. Don't let yourself be played. Check out "And Nobody Died in Boston Either." Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
If you think for 1 second that the Capitol will ever treat us fairly, you are lying to yourselves. Because we know who they are and what they do. This is what they do, and we must fight back. You can torture us and bomb us. Fire is catching. And if we burn, you burn with us.
Good evening.
Are you awake yet? I hope.
We've tried and we've tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming, and it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet, not giving up. Revolution Radio.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Once again, I announce I'm delighted to be featuring Sophia Smallstorm once again as my featured guest here on The Raw Deal. Sophia, please continue.
Okay, Jim. So I was going into biology and life. We started with Wiki's definition that there's no consensus on what life is. It's just a characteristic or characteristics that separate physical entities with biological processes and those without. So in the organization of life, all of its different divisions and classes, you start with life at the top, which we don't really know how to define, but then underneath them we have what's called, underneath that word, that king term, we have super realms, super kingdoms or empires, archaea, bacteria, and eukarya. And humans are eukaryotic. Archaea are life forms that are very, very hardy. We're talking small. They can live in volcanic vents, ice shelves. Bacteria can't. They're very different. They are susceptible to destruction by extreme heat or cold or harsh chemicals, right? Eukaryotes have differentiated cell walls. We have a nucleus with a wall around it, and the cytoplasm around that is that's how our cells are made up. And so underneath those super kingdoms, you have kingdoms. Kingdoms would be animalia, plants, plantae, fungi, protista, archaea, and bacteria, again, come at these other levels. And then phylum are in all of those. So animalia, the kingdom of animalia has 31 phyla. Plantae have 14. Fungi have 8. So below phylum, you have class, and this has to do with the levels of complexity of organisms. And, you know, a lot of these people, these biologists and zoologists, they fight and argue about how many and what is actually what kind of thing. And they keep poking around and they keep moving things from one classification to another. So, and then of course you have, what do you have? The lowest, at the bottom is species, then above that genus, family, order, class, and then you get to phylum. So phylum is kind of in the middle. So Jim, I looked up nematodes. Nematodes are a tubular thread-like phylum among animals. And people, experts think there's anywhere from 10,000 to 100 million species within nematodes. So nematodes are a phylum of life that's thread-like, tubular. It's a kind of a worm, you could say. And now I'm going to read from Nathan Cobb. He was a nematologist, and this is what he wrote in 1914. In short, if all the matter in the universe, except the nematodes, were swept away, our world would still be dimly recognizable. And if, as disembodied spirits, we could then investigate it, we would find its mountains, hills, vales, rivers, lakes, and oceans represented by a film of nematodes. The location of towns would be decipherable, since for every massing of human beings, there would be a corresponding massing of nematodes. Trees would stand still in ghostly rows representing our streets and highways because of the nematodes that live in them and on them. The location of the various plants and animals would still be decipherable, and had we sufficient knowledge, in many cases, even their species could be determined by an examination of their erstwhile nematode parasites. So this tubular worm is everywhere, and nematodes represent 90% of animals on the ocean floor, 80%, I think it is, of all individual animals on Earth. And they are parasitic. They are in plant, every other kind of plant and animal. They're parasites of vertebrates, parasites of everything alive. So what that Nathan Cobb guy was saying was, if you took everything off the earth, every kind of matter, but you left the nematodes, you would still have this, like, these ghostly outlines of everything that ever existed, because nematodes were in them or on them. Okay?
Yes.
So nematodes may be microscopic, or they can be very visible. They're these small little tubular animals with lips and teeth. They're muscular. They have no stomach. They produce enzymes to digest the universe they feed on and help to destroy or degenerate or regenerate. Sorry. Now, they can be free living or parasitic. So what they do in the soil, where 90% of them live, they regulate the community, the bacterial population. Nematodes can eat up to 50,000 bacteria per minute. Now, there's even an Antarctic nematode, P. Davidi. So you know that they have really gotten around. You can breed nematodes. You can buy them as a form of organic pest control. But basically, they hang, shroud, and mass everywhere on Earth. Okay. So as I'm studying all this stuff about viruses, do they exist? Do they not exist? Do they cause illness? Do they not cause illness? The terrain theory versus the germ theory. Germs don't make us sick. It's our own biological internal terrain that gets out of whack and off balance. So I began to think that, all right, germs may not infect us and make us sick, but parasites might. Right? And that's what this nematode is. It's a parasite. So that took me to the disease known as river blindness. Have you ever heard of that?
I may have, but I don't know anything about it. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so the medical term is, I'm not even going to say it right, onchocerciasis. It's called river blindness. A lot of sub-Saharan Africa has this, and it is, we are the definitive host, the vertebrate. The intermediate host for this river blindness is a black fly that lives near tropical rivers. So when you get multiple bites by these black flies, their larvae, The parasitic infection happens in us because the adult worms, I suppose these are the nematodes carried by the black flies. That's what it is. So the larvae of the nematodes start to take up residence in our bodies. We are the definitive hosts. The flies are the intermediate hosts. And flies, as you may or may not know, bite humans because they get what they like to eat, which is a blood meal. So the microfilaria, the tiny larvae that live in us from these nematodes, are what disrupt our health. And they cause terrible skin conditions as well as blindness because these larvae of the nematodes chronically invade tissues of the eye. So prevention, the only prevention is to avoid being bitten by these flies. So there was a drug, Jim, developed in the 1970s. It was put into medical use in the 1980s. It was donated by Merck for mass dissemination to Africans in the 1990s. And it actually was what its creators won the Nobel Prize for this find. And that find was ivermectin. Okay?
Yes.
So we have heard an awful lot about ivermectin lately, how it is the cure for COVID, supposedly, if you believe in COVID. It is taken as a prophylactic. It's used in veterinary medicine to control parasites. It's an antiparasitic, and that's what it became famous for. The way it started was there was a Japanese biochemist, Satoshi Omura, who found an unusual Streptomyces bacteria in the soil in southeastern Japan. So he sent this Streptomyces bacteria to a guy at Merck, William Campbell, and that guy found that it killed roundworms in mice. So he began to isolate the active compounds in this Streptomyces, and he named these compounds avermectins. So then the chemists at Merck combined the avermectins to make an improved form, which they called ivermectin, and they marketed that as an oral treatment for endo, internal, and ecto, external parasites. So this Merck drug is, you know, the veterinarian's go-to. And what I have begun to put together is that you, of course, have heard of this. Everybody listening to this show has heard of this, that the materials, the what they call the undeclared components of the COVID vaccines, are very peculiar in nature. Have you gotten wind of any of these very strange, let's just call them, there are fibers, there are little constructs. Have you heard about this?
Yes, I've shown photographs of them on many of my shows, Sophia. You're absolutely right.
Okay. So these are what I would call, Jim, electroparasites. Okay?
Yeah.
The evolutionary biologist Lynn Margulis, she was the wife of the famous sci-fi writer Carl Sagan. She was very famous for coming up with the term endosymbiont. So we human beings are very complex life forms. We have high energy demands. So we have incorporated and integrated other life forms into our bodies, like bacteria. Bacteria digest our food. We don't. We get to sit down, look at the menu, choose the food, eat it, chew it, go yum yum, that tastes good, swallow it, but we don't digest it. Bacteria process the food in our gut. So this is called endosymbiosis. Inside, we have a symbiotic relationship with another kingdom of life and super kingdom. We are eukaryotes. We host bacteria to do certain energy producing jobs for us, right?
Yes.
So in our bodies, we are finding in the bodies of the vaccinated and in the contents of the vaccine vials, some very strange things that seem to be electromagnetic. They respond to electromagnetic frequencies, or they have electromagnetic charge to them. They dance around and move. They seem to be aware. And a long time ago, I did a lot of research on this condition called Morgellon syndrome. And these people that, you know, definitely are not dreaming, all over the world have found that their bodies are issuing very strange materials, including fibers. And it all seems to start with fibers. These fibers that when sent to a lab, no lab could actually categorize or identify. They call them unknown, unidentifiable fibers. And Clifford Carnicom, who made the documentary Aerosol Crimes and had the Carnicom Institute and his website for many, many years, and he's still active, he went to the highest mountains of New Mexico to collect the fallout from what he called aerosol spraying by these mysterious planes in the sky. And what did he pick up in the fallout? And just environmental samples taken in the hills of New Mexico, found these very strange fibers and also found dried human red blood cells. Now, what are blood cells doing in environmental fallout? And when he did certain experiments, and I have to say Clifford is rigorous, he does very, very controlled scientific experiments. He studied a lot to do this correctly. In his little lab, he found that these fibers could be replicated in a petri dish. They would replicate themselves, so they were self-replicating, as were the blood cells. And the fibers, being tubular, could make blood cells within them, these artificial human blood cells. And everybody's body, he could generate his experiments out of tissue from just about anyone, all right, not just Morgellons people. So Morgellons, a friend of mine put it really well. She said that it is a nanotech disease. This is how you would explain it to a complete green newbie, a nanotech disease. And years ago, very few people knew what nanotech was. But today, they know, because mainstream media is constantly bragging about all these scientific innovations that are nanotechnological. So nano means less than a micron in size. And a micron is 1/1,000,000th of a meter. So just to give you a sense of scale, the average human hair is anywhere from 50 to 100 microns in diameter. All right?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. So I did a talk, two talks, back in 2011, the first one, and 2012, the second one, From Chemtrails to Pseudo-Life. And in the first talk, you can find these on the internet, I said, could it be that artificial materials are being introduced into living things? And in that talk, I put a pyramid together that I called the nanotech pyramid. So if you draw a pyramid and you separate it into layers, the bottom layer would be materials, then the layer above it, structures, then processes and devices. So biology does this. Nanotechnology does this. It starts with materials that assemble into structures, self-assemble, you could say, that carry out processes, and the end result is a device that forms. So, for instance, you can even say that any organ in your body is made of these materials, base materials, that are assembled into structures, cells. They do a certain job, and that's an organ, your liver or your gallbladder or your, you know, thyroid, something. All of life is organized in this way, from basic materials that know how to make themselves into structures. And cells, as we know, constantly replenish themselves. They keep reproducing. So I would say that this, just looking at the contents of these COVID vials, they have in them what looks very much like all the stuff I showed in my pseudo-life talks, the Morgellons materials. And these are electroparasites. They are electroendosymbionts. They are synbio, synthetic biology, that is some now being, seems to be, from these mandates, in, this is the desire to inject this stuff into everybody. So I was putting some dots together. So ivermectin controls nematode reproduction. Morgellons is thought to be a nematode form. It's a tubular synthetic fiber, a synthetic nematode. Ivermectin helps certain people control Morgellons. This is what the Morgellons community uses on its lesions that issue all these raw materials out, these synthetic materials. So I had to theorize that ivermectin, if it helps these people with these, whose bodies are issuing just masses of these artificial fibers, then it's an anti-parasite and anti-parasitic. So this, the reason they're banning ivermectin is because it controls parasite reproduction, and we are experiencing the introduction of electroparasites into our bodies. Does that make sense?
I agree with that, Sophia. And I have, of course, myself taken ivermectin. And I think you're correct in what you're explaining here. Go forward.
Okay. So one researcher said, I have this in my notes, this person had advanced degrees up the arm and credentials, and said, these are self-assembling nanoparticle vaccines. So what are they? They're the materials that know how to self-assemble into structures on the nanotech pyramid. Now, what the people from Reutlingen, where that press conference was held, the German and Austrian scientists and lawyers, what they were looking at in their slides were more complex even. There were little airplane shapes, little, you know, tiny devices that looked like chips. Now, these aren't just structures. These are more like devices. These things must have some kind of operation capability. So, and the Morgellons people were noticing stuff like that coming out of their bodies. Sometimes the little devices, they would be like crystalline quartz. They would have inscriptions, letters and numbers on them that you could see under a microscope. So how is a person's body making something with letters or numbers on it? It must be self-assembled from some other basic materials that their body is making. So there are programs written into all of this. So the nanotech pyramid is material, structures, processes, devices, right? And now, as I look on the internet, I see that there is something called nanoarrays that they produce in nanotechnology. And they're using these nanoarrays all over the place. Nanoarrays are arrangements of nano-sized objects that form devices used for DNA hybridization, among other things. So I'm looking at pictures of nanoarrays on the internet, and some of them look very, you know, organic, like plants on the ocean floor, and others look like grids or boards for electronics. And so here's a headline from 2018, hybrid nanomaterials bristle with potential. So what is hybrid? Hybrid means organic material combined with inorganic material like metals. But the crux of this, Jim, is that everything is conductive. Nanoarrays are used as sensors. Translation, they are artificial intelligence. So I had to conclude that all this stuff that people were finding in the vaccine vials and in the blood of people who had been vaccinated were devices that operate on AI. This is AI being put into us.
What may be the ability to manipulate using AI is being put into us. I don't know that the AI per se, like the graphene oxide, seems to create an interface that allows 5G to interact with the human brain and manipulate our thoughts and our feelings. So, but I'm intrigued by everything you're explaining, Sophia. I have no doubt that you're going to have a lot of response from our audience. Go for it.
Well, can you restate what you just said? You have heard, or what did you just say? That 5G is going to do what, or may do what?
Well, the fact is that graphene oxide, which is the flimsiest material known to man, is in these vaccines, and graphene oxide creates the opportunity for an interface between 5G and the human brain, which I suspect can be used to affect our thoughts and our feelings. So when they talk about, you know, under the Great Reset, I own nothing and I'm happier than I've ever been, it's not because you own nothing that you're happy. It's because they're affecting your moods and your feelings to make virtually everyone on Earth robotic and have the same thoughts and the same feelings by means of manipulating their brains and their feelings using 5G and the graphene oxide interface. This is my suspicion.
I see. Okay. Yes. Yes. So, Jim, the word you used for graphene, you said flimsiest. So let's just recast graphene as not flimsy. It is the thinnest. It is one atom thick. So it's basically pencil lead graphite, which is a form of carbon. These are called allotropes of carbon. Diamonds are a form of carbon, allotrope. That's what a diamond is. So graphene is a one atom thick layer of graphite, and it is the strongest substance known and the most conductive. And I posted on my blog, I have to ask people to watch this. It is somebody called James Tour, and he says talking about the mystery of the origins of life. And I only got into the first 5 minutes yesterday because I had to go, but it's on my blog. He says that you can turn a cockroach into graphene that becomes so valuable scientifically that it completely blows away the value of the cockroach. So this was a new one for me, that you could actually take a life form, render it into carbon, and then render it into this form of carbon that can sell for millions of dollars.
Yeah, that's pretty stunning stuff.
Yeah. So this graphene oxide, or graphene hydroxide, as some people are saying, it is a conductive material, a very versatile conductive material that has already been used in nanobiotech that now is being apparently put into us. And it is colloidal. The hydrogel is a colloid. And I did a newsletter a while back when I first learned of colloidal chemistry and what colloids really are and what they do. They're all conductive materials. They're very super. Yes.
We're up against a break, Sophia, so hold that thought. We are inviting callers to number 540-352-4452, 540-352-4452. Mitchell will handle your call, get you on with Sophia and me. Any of the subject we've been discussing here are fair game. So take advantage of this unique opportunity. Sophia makes very few appearances here, and I'm just delighted to have her today, which just happens to be a present on my birthday. So I'm delighted Sophia is here. Call in and you'll get on the air with Sophia and me today, a very special day.
Take a moment to thank the listeners and hosts for all their support that has made Revolution Radio one of the biggest platforms for free speech in an ever-growing dark world of censorship. Unfortunately, this platform for free speech has never been free. We need the support of the people. It is the people like you, yes, you, that keeps the station in the front lines of the battle against tyranny and oppression. Please help support Revolution Radio so free speech will not be silenced in a world that seems to be going deaf to the real truth. With your support, we will be able to become an even bigger pillar of light in a dark world.
Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Revolution Radio.
Mitch.
Join Revolution Radio every Wednesday, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Studio B for Momentary Zen with host Zen Garcia at freedomslips.com, the People Station.
Even the government admits that 9/11 was a conspiracy. But did you know that it was an inside job? That Osama had nothing to do with it? That the Twin Towers were blown apart by a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes? That Building 7 collapsed 7 hours later because of explosives planted in the building? Barry Jennings was there. He heard them go off and felt himself stepping over dead people. The U.S. Geological Survey conducted studies of dust gathered from 35 locations in Lower Manhattan and found elements that would not have been there had this not been a nuclear event. Ironically, that means the government's own evidence contradicts the government's official position. 9/11 was brought to us compliments of the CIA, the neocons of the Department of Defense, and the Mossad. Don't let yourself be played. Read America Nuked on 9/11. Available at moonrockbooks.com. That's moonrockbooks.com.
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and freedomslips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Well, I'm not surprised that we have a couple of callers already lined up. We have Fred from Colorado standing by, for example. Fred, join the conversation. Fred, are you there?
Yeah, Jim, do you hear me?
Now we do.
Yeah, hey, listen. I do a show on Rev Radio here on Tuesdays, but I've been following Sophia for 4 or 5 years now from when I first discovered. She had been doing some speeches about dimensional thought. And, you know, it's not surprising to me that she's been able to expand our envelope of information about what's happening right now. Thank you so much, Sophia.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice of you. Thank you.
Fred, you have further comments or thoughts or questions for Sophia?
Well, it seems that since you're illuminating the issue that we're being infested with this parasite, what do you think our goal for creating our own new culture should be? I mean, how can we change things, or are we going to learn how to deal with this?
Again, you know, if Clifford Carnicom is right, and it's already in everybody to some extent, these other life forms, he calls them cross-domain kingdoms. They have crossed bacteria with archaea, and that's now showing up in eukarya, which is us, and we're actually, it's self-replicating in us. But to me, that's the low level of it. That's the materials form. The Morgellons people were able to somehow issue devices. I haven't seen any devices coming out of my body, nor have I seen fibers. Although people say that we're shedding them all the time, we just don't know. But this vaccine program is, I think it's going to gather the material stuff in the nanotech assembly line and introduce devices into us which will coordinate those materials. So the best thing we can do, in my opinion, this is my opinion, is not get vaxxed, okay? Because so far, so good.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. Not getting vaxxed. That's one of the themes of the programs for the last year or so, Sophia. So you're spot on there. Fred, further thoughts or comments?
Well, I just wanted to thank her so much for being who she is. And I've enjoyed it. And I know that you've been taken down on YouTube quite a bit. How can we hear more of you now?
Well, Fred, people can invite me to do shows with them. Strangely enough, very few people are interested in this. I say this. I say the people who have hung with me are the people who are willing to go into more complex an exploration, you know. And I'm happy to do a show with you or with anybody else who would like to do that. And that will put more shows out there. I do not have a YouTube channel. And many years ago, I made the good decision not to. Therefore, I could never be taken down, right? I would never sit and cry about how my YouTube channel was taken down because I didn't have one. But yes, you're right. My material has been taken off other people's channels. So you can go to my blog, sophiasmallstorm.com. Sophia is with an F. And you can find my shows and whatnot linked on the podcast page, and they'll frequently be on the blog.
Very good, Fred. Fred, I want to thank you for an excellent call. Paul's standing by from California. Paul, join the conversation.
Hi, Sophia. Hi, Jim.
Hi. So, I know you.
How you doing? So, Jim, don't you just love it when Sophia always says, I'm just an ordinary person. I'm nothing special. I'll get a kick out of that. I highly recommend, Jim, for you and for anybody else listening to go on to Sophia's site about the sky and watch a video that she's just recently posted about the origins, the mystery of the origins of life. I just watched it. The very first video up on her blog. I just watched it last night. And I was actually probably going to email you about it, Sophia, because I just think it's amazing. It's one of the more interesting and amazing lectures I've seen in years, don't you think?
Well, look, I have to say, here's where I'm more ordinary than ordinary. I only watched 5 minutes of it so far. But that's why I put it up, because I loved the first 5 minutes.
So, well, I can honestly tell you that you won't be disappointed in the remaining 45 minutes or so.
Yeah, we have. Okay, so my blog, sophiasmallstorm.com, that is the page on which that is posted. And thank you, Paul. What do you have to tell us about the video? Come on now, spit it out. What is so great about it?
Well, the thing, and just again for everybody, it's called James Tour, the mystery of the origin of life. Essentially, there's so many things. It's so unbelievably complex, all these life processes. And then he's essentially coming at it from a less than scientific view, but more of, I'm assuming he's religious or Christian. He gets to that at the very end because he certainly believes that, you know, this was no happenstance or accident. And essentially he mocks all the people in science that claim that they are, you know, that they're doing all these different things, such as they're creating synthetic cells, that they're making all this progress towards being able to create these biological entities, which, you know, he essentially, he outs them as being frauds and liars. So, and again, there's no doubting the brilliance of this man. This guy is Jim Fetzer on steroids when he just starts talking. And he just delivers this stream of consciousness, and he's absolutely just packed with scientific knowledge. He actually, impresses you in terms of this is somebody you. There's no doubt you know what he's talking about. But again, if you haven't seen the whole thing, Sophia, I encourage you to finish it because I'm going to watch it again. But I just thought it was one of the more amazing videos I've seen in years, and I always go to. There's about five or six sites that I have. And yours is one that I go to at least once or more a week just to see what the latest is. And that's one of the other great services I think that you perform. And I don't know how many people are aware of your site, but I mention it to all the people. And just one more thing while I'm talking about you, is it was because of what you said on a podcast over a year ago now that I went down the road I did and increased my knowledge about this current scam and about what viruses are and are not. You said that viruses were essentially not really living in the conventional sense and that they were inorganic. And I remember hearing that and I said, what? And until then I had always thought, just like most people, that viruses were just some kind of an organism, right? I gave as much thought to viruses as I suppose anybody else did. I just assumed, you know, they existed because we were told about them. And I didn't know anything more. And so shortly after that, I typed in definition of virus, you know, or what is a virus? And, you know, you get like millions of hits, and I just started reading. And 3-4 hours later, I came away shaking my head, and I just knew that most of what I read was probably not true. And well, so there you go.
Let me just say this. Yesterday, I was taken with an email I got from a friend of mine, and he said it's okay to use his name, Harry Blazer. Harry is a brilliant human being. He started life as a professional jazz musician, okay? So that just tells you artistic people can be smart too. All right. So he says that he believes that this digitization of life is the dumbing down of life and its inherent complexity. He says in his email, what makes you think that every decision when it comes to life can be described in terms of binary form, 0 or 1? So do you think that AI and its algorithms describe all there is to describe? How does nature, you know, there's this Werner Heisenberg that he quoted who said, what we observe is not nature itself, but it's nature exposed to our method of questioning. And this humanity and life being put into binary form, algorithms, by these, he calls them arrogant, self-assured slobs that think their worldview of how things work is the way it works. But it's only a fraction of the understanding of how things really work and the complexity and interrelatedness of everything. So, you know, it's like,
yeah, what you just said, a fraction of the understanding, that is precisely what made me think of this video. In fact, because it was fresh in my mind, and also I just felt that it fits so well. It kind of dovetailed a lot with your presentation today. That's
yes.
What I mentioned.
Yes. So I was taken with this email that I got from this person that I know, and I posted James Tour because I got it through some other, you know how it is? A day, Monday, Tuesday, whatever day, certain things fall into your lap and they're all connected. And you know what? That's part of life, folks. And it's not an algorithm, because somebody will send me an email about something and then I will read something else and I will go somewhere else and boom, here's the James Tour video. And I go, you know what? I haven't even watched this, but I'm putting it on my blog. And then Paul watches it and he comes on the show and he gets to tell you about it because I hadn't done my homework. Now, algorithms didn't determine that.
Right. The other bit, I will just make a quick observation. I don't know if we have other callers, but I couldn't help but thinking of the experience I had when you were talking and about basically just being able to see things and about these autistic people and how they explain to us, you know, what it is that they see. And I think we've all seen things in our minds. Sometimes I wish I had the mind I did back in my 20s and 30s. I just had, I don't know, at the time, I felt like an amazing mind. And just things would come into my mind. Where'd that come from? But all of a sudden it was there. And in many cases, it was like a solution or an idea to something that, you know, I was thinking about or working on. Well, anyway, I remember reading a book about Tesla back in the 90s sometime. It's a book by Margaret Cheney called Tesla, Man Out of Time, which I think is probably one of the better works out there on his life. And I remember getting about halfway through it and thinking to myself that they described all the things that he invented and what he did and what he came up with. And all I could think of is he just saw this in his mind. There's no other explanation. Things were just given to him. And it just reminded me of talks I used to hear starting back in the 80s and the 90s about the universal mind or universal intelligence or universal consciousness. And I think that's one of the things that they're probably trying to take away from all of us with all the ingredients in the food and the stuff in the air and the water and the vaccine schedule for kids. I really do believe that they're trying to disconnect us from what we would otherwise have access to.
Yeah, some people would call that source, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, we are all unique. We do all have these brain waves or downloads, problems that get solved suddenly because something occurs to us. And, you know, I don't know if it's that we have organized within our brain all this background stuff and the brain is constantly hunting on some level that we're not conscious of. And it says, hey, look, what about this? or if it comes from some source, or I don't know how. Jim, you've done work on intelligence. Where would you say that it comes from when you have suddenly a solution?
Well, there's a lot of subconscious processing that takes place over which, you know, putting things together. I mean, it's like I have some of my best thoughts just as I'm about to fall asleep. And I know if I don't get up and write them down, I'm not going to be able to recollect in the morning. So I make the effort. But, you know, there's the way in which thinking proceeds has to do with associations between what are known as signs, which are things that stand for other things in some respect or other, some of which are icons that look like, smell like, taste like what they stand for. Others are indices causally related to that for which they stand. Third, being symbolic, merely habitually associated. So it's fairly complicated how human thought processes work. But once you understand these are the modes of association, you understand how typical thought processes, you know, work in a very straightforward fashion. Just an illustration, looking out of the window in Duluth one winter, it was all foggy, and that reminded me by resemblance of a postcard I'd got from saying, you know, nothing but fog, saying Seattle, made me think of my son, Brett, who lives there, who is a playwright and author, which made me think of his first play, which he wrote as his senior thesis at Reed, where his mother and I both came to hear her, and where I couldn't tell watching it or reading it, actually reading the script in advance, whether it were a drama, a serious, or a comedy. And when watching it performed, it was an hilarious comedy, indicating to me he really knew what he was doing with a theater. But I mean, that's just a typical human thought process of association, which you can understand if you appreciate that minds are sign-using systems and association between signs are the key, which, by the way, I mentioned in passing is why strings of zeros and ones and digital machines are not thinking things. They can be designed by programmers to simulate to a high degree human thought, but they do not themselves possess thought. So what's going on here, I long since concluded, and I founded an international journal entitled Minds and Machines, where I solely edited it for 10 years, and most of my contributors believe in the computational model of the mind, which I was a major critic, along with John Searle of Berkeley. What I believe is they have taken that message to heart, so instead of trying to take inanimate things and turn them into thinking things, or taking human beings and seeking to make them more robotic, at which they appear to be having a considerable degree of success. Paul, I'm really pleased you call in. We do have two other callers. I want to bring them in, but I want you to stand by. Fred from the chat room, please join the conversation, Fred.
Jim, I was on earlier with you. I was just so fascinated listening. I didn't really have anything to contribute.
Oh, okay. But that's fine, Fred. Then we got William standing by here. I believe you're in Colorado. Bill, go ahead. Bill, join the conversation.
Yeah. Hey, guys, and thanks, Mitch. No, I'm in I'm in Virginia right now, actually.
Okay.
There was going to be a few things like the photographic memory stuff and pie I was going to talk about, but it's probably not enough time. But the nematodes, I'm really glad, Sophia, that was something I was kind of dealing with years ago. I don't mean physically myself, but I had forgotten that issue. So I'm really glad she brought that up. But we have to remember, the so-called vaccines are, the design is to become, the purpose is to be, the goal is to be self-spreading. So self-replicating and self-spreading. So it physically has to be able to move. Nematodes have memory. So they themselves are little computers. They communicate, they work in colonies, you know, some do. They can physically move, spread, multiply, and the whole bit. So you combine that artificial techniques and electricity and so on, electrochemistry, you're going to get some kind of calculations going on. But the other thing we need to look into is artificial blood. This is all going to connect to artificial blood to replace live blood, okay? And without going into too much about that, but basically, I guess that's where I should just end it. But it's combination science, which I keep bringing up occasionally over the years. And I used to have a partial photographic memory. I mean, I still partially do, but I had to make a choice, either become full photographic memory at a great loss to life or not. And I made the choice to not become fully photographic. Okay. So that's a little bit of background for me. Yeah, thanks. And great show. I got to get both of you on my show sooner or later.
Very interesting, Bill. Yeah, Sophia, go ahead.
No, I think have you heard of eidetic vision, Jim or Bill?
No, tell us, yep. Sophia, and maybe it'll come to mind. Go ahead.
It's when you see something, you remember it. I think artists who do, you know, representational art, they have eidetic vision to an extent because they can look at, for instance, a plant and they hold it in their eyes, in their mind long enough that it translates into marks on paper that look exactly like what they're seeing. So photographic memory vision is also called eidetic vision. And if you had that or have that, that's pretty great. But I understand what you mean when you say you decided to give it up to have more normal existence.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, good point.
So, Paul, rejoin the conversation.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I would only add to what you said, Jim, which was a nice kind of a personal and a complex, you know, shall we say, explanation of how the mind works. I would add to it sort of a simple idea that I heard from Kevin Trudeau. I don't know if you two remember Kevin Trudeau. He was of the infomercial fame, but he talked about the human mind was both a transmitter and a receiver. And I've heard other people talk about this too. And I think that is, in my mind, no doubt to be true. The only other thing that I would add on this whole subject of vaccines is I think it's important to not forget that this is an attack. So, yeah, the reason that we don't want to take a vaccine from any of these people is because they're not trying to do us any good. So I believe it is an attack. And before I go, before I forget, Jim, if you'll indulge me, happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Jim Fetzer.
Happy birthday.
Jim, I feel terrible because I didn't start with telling you what a great pleasure it is and honor to be on your birthday. And will you have a cake? And how many candles will be on your cake?
Well, there would be, 81 candles, Sophia. Oh, that's quite a few. Yeah. In fact, we had a family thing, and my grandkids said, you know, are you one? Are you two? And they had to go through 81. I mean, you know, it was quite an event. We had great fun to celebrate yesterday because they wouldn't have been available today with school and all. So it's all playing out very well. And I regard it as a special kind of birthday present to be featuring you here today on my show, Sophia.
Well, that's very sweet. Thank you. And happy birthday, Jim. And look at how many candles. That's unbelievable.
I did not expect to live to 81, though I have other relatives who did live into their 80s. So I suppose perhaps I shouldn't be surprised. Paul, did you want to come back to another point?
Well, I was just going to say we all hope that you continue for many years. And just so you know, maybe you forgot, but we are both Sagittarius. Our birthdays are only separated by 4 days.
Yes, 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 yes. Sophia may have her own reflections on astrological signs and all that, but I appreciate it, Paul, and I appreciate very much all the contributions you made to the show over quite a few years, Paul. I'm very fond of getting your input, even if intermittently we may have our differences, which are more a matter of procedure and protocol than have to do with content.
To me, it's a gathering place. That's mainly what it is. It's a gathering place that's been social, and I've thoroughly enjoyed it, and I hope to continue. Go ahead, Sophia.
Excellent. Sophia.
Yes, I don't. Paul is on on the call for every show that I do. So I'm honored that he dogs me like that.
Good, good. Did Bill have a further thought he wanted to add, Bill?
Just briefly. Well, first of all, try to get the family savant to blow those candles out for you. See how long it takes. But you know, with going back to pie real quick, pie is not an answer, and it was never really. People misunderstand the definition of pie. Even the best misunderstand the concept of pie. Pie is each individual number is a way to get closer to the truth and never get to it. And I don't mean it in the way most people talk about it, like the infinity. Pi does not have an infinite number, and there never will be. It's not a number that's infinitely long. There's each individual number along the calculation is a completely separate calculation that has a completely separate answer for a different reason. But
Bill,
see, it
Bill,
comes to,
yeah. Bill, pi is a ratio of the diameter of a circle to its circumference, and it turns out to be a non-terminating decimal that has no ending. So it is an infinite number. You're simply mistaken. There's a way you might want to describe it that makes your point, but in fact, technically, it's not correct.
No, that's actually a misunderstanding. There's a formula that if you keep following the formula, it'll never end. But there is an answer to exactly the distance of a curve or a circle compared to a straight line. And pi will always be shorter than the circle, but the other version of calculating it will always be greater and never meet the actual number.
William, it's a matter of the ratio of the respective distance of the diameter of a circle to its circumference. That is a fixed number, and it's a non-terminating decimal. It is an infinite number. So Sophia's example was just fascinating that you could have somebody who could calculate or know the number of pi out to a certain arbitrary number of digits when it has no end of digits.
Well, my point is the ratio is if you're always going to have the same ratio as far as diameter or radius, but the ratio of closeness to the truth is always off and further and further off.
Well, can I explain what I...
You're talking about an approximation. Yeah, Sophia, go right ahead.
Okay, so I'm not a mathematician, but I was thinking about pi, and I'll try to say this fast. If you drew a circle, even if you draw it perfectly with a compass and it's still imperfect, and you tried to measure that with a piece of string, you're never going to be able to get the measurement because you can never curve the string enough or correctly.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Como va? This is Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. I pulled some strings and gotten you front row seats to my new show, The Perfect Triangle. Live Friday, 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time on Revolution Radio Studio A. The Perfect Triangle is equilateral, three sides of the same length. In an angry, bipolar world, three perfect sides reveal many truths.
Body, mind, and spirit.
Thought, word, and deed.
Conspiracy, propaganda, and truth.
Natural health, allopathic tyranny, and your body.
Freedom, globalism, and sovereign nations.
And so much more. Each week, the Perfect Triangle will blast through fake news lies, champion the natural way and natural law, unravel the Orwellian deceptions of our corrupt government, reveal the satanic evil of globalist banks and transnational corporations. Tune in every Friday, 6 p.m. Eastern, to Revolution Radio, Studio A, for thoughtful discussions with free thinkers. Your calls are always welcome. The Perfect Triangle, with Giuseppe from the District of Criminals. Join me, won't you?
Don't
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
We did not engage in conflict.